They've been fighting for so long.
We have two countries that don't know what the fuck they're doing.
Very upset with Israel. Man, I mean, poo. This has been a fucking roller coaster ride. Hit the fucking record, man.
All right. Oh, but I'm recording, but just remember that this is going to be releasing a week from tomorrow. So,
yeah. That's true. It's been a fucking roller coaster ride. Yeah. And I mean, we're time traveling back in time to Tuesday. Yeah. This might not be, none of this shit might be usable. Folks, we'll be landing at Incheon. They said you couldn't do it. They said it's impossible. We pulled it off.
We're landing at Incheon.
Imagine him live tweeting and just like, the haters and losers said that we couldn't do it.
They said they needed more time. I said, get it done.
General Donald MacArthur.
They said that October would be the best time. And I said, there are monsoons, the likes of which you have never seen. The biggest.
I said,
monsoons.
Have you heard of a monsoon? They're not good. We'll never be able to land. They said it's crazy. I said it would be crazy to defend it.
I told them we needed high tide. High tide is when they said, and they said, oh, we like low tide. I said, no, low tide is no good. It must be high.
It's too low.
The tide must be high. It is too low.
How are you guys going?
Good, good.
Oh,
how are
good.
You doing?
Yeah, well, thank you.
All right. How the? You're in New Orleans?
Yep. Whereabouts are you guys?
Oh, what the fuck? I'm in Lake Charles.
Oh, wow.
And, yeah, like 4 hour from you.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've been through that.
And I'm in Houston by way of Sulphur and Lake Charles. So we're we're Gulf Coast boys.
That's what everybody says about Lake Charles. They're like, I've driven through there.
I think I've stopped, maybe. I don't know. But I know Lucinda Williams is from there. And the guy who owns Snake and Jake's is from there as well.
There's nothing to stop for, Elle. I mean, you do get the wonderful smells of the chemical plants
that we inhabit.
How much of the episode do you want to do about Incheon? And how much would you like to talk about the Moonies? Because
I definitely want to talk more about the Moonies. The plot of Incheon is so... There's so little going on in Incheon. Like, if we read through the Wikipedia plot, people would accuse us of skipping stuff, and we're not.
Yeah. Elle, yeah. This is a fucking stinker, girl. What did you
do? I know.
I was like, this is so boring. And then I Googled it, and it's like, rated one of the top 10 worst films of all time. And I was like, oh, my God.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's I didn't get through the final battle scene. I mean, we can talk about this all anyway.
I'm suddenly under the impression that I might be the only one who watched this entire thing.
I think you were.
Okay. Well, in that case, hey, listeners, welcome to another episode of Propagandos. It is Tuesday, June 24th, and we are excited to welcome one of the co-hosts of Hell to Pay. Please welcome journalist and author Elle Hardy. Elle, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
And we are discussing a movie called Incheon that you recommended. Now, Elle, how did you come across this movie?
Well, I'm writing a book on the Moonies at the moment. So Reverend Song Myung Moon and the Unification Church, which was the huge kind of mass wedding they were most famous for in the 70s and 80s. They did, you know, mass weddings at Madison Square Garden and things like that. But probably more recently, a lot of people might know them. They were sort of the reason behind the assassination of Shinzo Abe, the former Japanese prime minister, a few years ago. And it's sort of become like a very online meme that the assassin, you know, the most successful assassin in history. And his origin story is that his family his mother gave away their family fortune to the Unification Church, to the Moonies. They were much bigger in Japan than Korea. And I guess where this all fits into the movie that we're watching, the real thing sort of underneath the church, which was a very syncretic Korean shamanistic and American Pentecostal faith with a lot of, you know, all the weird sex stuff and you know, whatever Moon kind of felt like was this really virulent anti-communism. And that's what a lot of this film is really about. And it really was Moon's overarching purpose in life. He was one of the founders and funders of the World Anti-Communist League, got up to all sorts of mischief in Latin America in the 80s and whatnot. And yeah, that's why they decided to make this glorious propaganda film.
So why did the Moonies get started? What hole were they trying to fill in South Korean culture?
Well, Song Yeom-moon is the second coming of Christ. I don't know if you heard about that, Connor, but that's mostly what they're doing. So...
Yeah, look, it really depends who you speak to. The hole that he was filling, I mean, you know, some people will say that it was something that was orchestrated by various international intelligence agencies, including the American CIA. I don't know if it was quite that simple, but basically he'd had visions of seeing God when he was a young boy in North Korea. And at the time, so North Korea went through a big Pentecostal revival in 1907, and it was called the Jerusalem of the East. So there was about 100,000 to 150,000 converts to what we would now call Pentecostalism in Pyongyang. And so there was also a really big, there was a huge wave of migrants when the Korean War broke out. And when they saw that the communists were on that side and they weren't going to be so on board with Christians. And Song Yeom-moon wound up being detained, and he said that he was tortured and imprisoned by communists for a number of years. And then on his release, he sort of has a combination of miracles and things happen to him along the way. Again, it is so tied up in the mythology of the church that you're not sure exactly how much was real and how much wasn't. But basically, there's a lot of holes, I suppose, that he's filling. There is this incredibly wretched, impoverished country that has just been through Japanese occupation, a really brutal civil war. There is the newfound admiration for Americans, you know, for Americans coming in and saving from the communists and you know, the role that America played in the Pacific in World War II. Traditional conquerors of the Korean Peninsula were China and Japan. And so a lot of Korean people welcomed a different power, a different presence in the region. And also I think just the spiritual need after you've gone through these really wretched, you know, just horrific wars and poverty and disease and everything that goes along with that. And, you know, being conquered by the Japanese and, There was a real spiritual yearning as well. And I guess as we can get into a little bit further, there was a fair amount of politics going on too.
Yeah, I could only
it should
imagine.
Be said that like South Korea, if you've known a lot of South Koreans, you might come away with the notion that like a lot of them are Christian, but they are part of Christian sects that you would not really associate with maybe like Asia, if you know, like Filipinos or like different Asian Christian backgrounds. There's a lot of like Calvinists, right, in Korea. Like there are waves of kind of missionary work that reach Korea that blossom into communities that are like not dead outside of Korea, but have had like a much longer, like lasting effect, right? And so the Unification Church, as I see it, correct if I'm wrong, Al, is like a domestic evangelical movement, right? It takes like some of the background of Christian missionary work that had already kind of embedded itself in the populace of South Korea and makes it more overtly like Korean, right? Kind of ties it in with some of their like social mores, or at least attempts to, right? Because the weird thing about it is, like you said, right, it's more successful almost abroad after a while than it is in Korea.
Yeah, much, much more successful, particularly in Japan and the United States. Yeah, I mean, Korea's got a really interesting entanglement, I guess you'd almost say with Christianity. And I mean, this is what, you know, Korean sociologists, the term that they will use. Traditional Korean religion is quite shamanistic, and there just is something that when a lot of people in Korea have come into contact, and I mean, look, it's happened all over the world, but it's a particular phenomenon in Korea, when people have come into contact with Christianity and sort of overlaid that on their traditional beliefs, that they kind of look around and say, well, that means I'm Jesus. And there was a...
many such cases.
Yeah. And that there was actually a phenomenon, I think maybe in the 70s in Korea, that they called the selfed Christ, or the self Christ, because there were something like 60 or 70 different people who declared themselves Christ in a very short period of time. Moon very much had his own distinct theology, which is very complex, is much more to do, as much to do with geopolitics as anything, I guess I would say. And it's probably a little bit too in the weeds to go into for these purposes. But yeah, he was certainly able to blend a lot of things, but he was very, very much a creature of his time, the politics of the age, coming out of, just this completely shattered world, and then sort of trying to you know, piece together a mosaic of theology and worldview out of all of that.
So Incheon was financed by the Mooney Church, somewhat in secret, I understand it, right? It was not like known, I guess, before I think the premiere, that it was so entangled with the church. Like, I think the story is that like Moon basically couldn't help himself at like a premiere in Los Angeles and just like spilled the beans. And everybody's like, oh, wait, what the fuck? This is like a Mooney movie? This shitty movie is produced by the Moonies?
Yeah, I mean, I think as you can see from some of the acting, I think as maybe as like the cast members realize as they're going along, and you can definitely see whose agent got them their check up front and whose agent whose agent only got them paid in installments or something like that. But yeah, look, the Moonies had such an international web of commerce and religious, you know, not-for-profit secret organizations and things. There was always money being moved around. Everything's always very opaque. It's just kind of the way that they do business. This was really Moon's, in some ways, it might have been seen as his crowning achievement. It was very clearly a passion project.
I mean, just moving money around through secret organizations, it just seems like they were destined to come to Hollywood at some point in time and just like launder money through these big projects. I don't want to speculate, but I imagine that might have happened in this, because it had a budget of $46 million. Yeah, it was released for like maybe a couple of weeks, and it was such a flop, they pulled it out of theaters and it made $5.2 million box office.
Yikes. Like 40 million, like 30 million of which was like over budget, which is like, oh no.
And I mean, and this is 40 million in what was made in 1980, I think. So yeah, just that is an obscene amount of money.
Yeah. So Connor, you want to give us a plot synopsis?
I will give you the quickest plot synopsis I can. It will be quite easy. So this movie is centered around the invasion of Incheon, the Battle of Incheon during the Korean War. This movie opens up with the North Koreans moving past the 38th parallel into South Korea, and the people are fleeing to Seoul. Now, the North Koreans, according to the plot of the movie, they've just got all these Soviet tanks, which you get to see in the movie. These tanks just roll through houses and villages, and it's just complete.
They love murdering South Korean civilians. They cannot, like, every time they pop up, like, into the corner of a scene, immediate machine gun fire. They're, like, blasting just, like, refugees fleeing. It's something.
It's pretty, the action scenes are pretty much the only worthwhile thing of watching in this movie. I don't want to say it saves the movie, because it absolutely does not. And I mean, the whole movie is just about the buildup and the meetings and deliberations that go around the approval of General Douglas MacArthur invading Incheon, with his plan of a frogman operation to light a lighthouse and get everybody to invade into this port while the tide is perfect. It's before monsoon season. It's like the only perfect time to do it. And then there's a subplot about a woman whose husband is in the military and he's cheating on her with a South Korean woman.
Awful.
And she's got to drive all these kids to what ends up being a convent. I think I'm doing a pretty good job of explaining it. The movie is very chaotic and hard to follow along at times. And the cut that you shared with us, Elle, seems to be from a TV station that, Alec, you said that the Moonies actually owned at one point in time.
So the what is it called? The Watermark, Connor, in the corner is for the Good Life TV network, which the Unification Church bought in like the fucking 1980s and released this as a... So release this as like a TV cut, right? So it's in 4:3 aspect ratio, which is, it looks crazy nowadays. There's so much, Connor, like ADR and cuts. Yeah. And some of the cuts are very obviously like of cursing or racial slurs. It's bizarre.
I did notice that too. One thing that I really want to point out, because we're talking about these action sequences, is that this is directed by Terrence Young, who, listeners, if you're a movie buff, you know he directed 3 James Bond movies. So he knows the stuff about minimal take action film, but he also is rumored to have directed the 6-hour Saddam Hussein biography.
Yes.
And so this guy seems to just be like willing to take a check from the most controversial people. I do want to ask you since you've been researching the Moonies, can you identify parts that it's like glaringly obvious that their influence is in this? I mean, I know there were some Moonies as extras, but what else?
Oh my gosh, there are so many things. There's all sorts of ticks and flights of fancy. I think I would say that the thing that really stood out to me, Moonies had a massive armaments manufacturer in South Korea called Tongil. And they also still have a gun factory in Pennsylvania in the US today. And so I really got the sense that it was sort of a weapons showcase.
Awesome.
Yeah. They had huge contracts with the Korean military. We can maybe go a little bit into that. So just by way of background, so after the Civil War, a strongman takes over South Korea. You know, the country's partitioned. Syng Myung-ri, he's a pretty nasty authoritarian dude, you know, probably installed by the Americans just to, you know, have...
But he was elected!
Yeah.
He was elected! No takesies backsies!
just to have, you know, someone to keep a lid on things. Then in 1961, a group of young officers led by Major General Park Chung-hee launched a surprise coup. Like, it even just completely blasted American intelligence, embassy, everyone away. And the guy who was actually probably the architect of the coup was a guy called Kim Jong-pil. And so he was a really bright young intelligence officer. He'd been trained at Fort Benning in the US, which was later home of School of the Americas, you know, the camp for psychopaths and torturers and dictators in Latin America in the 80s.
Oh, we know about that.
Of course.
Big fans.
Yeah. Love this stuff. And Kim Jong-pil also went on to marry a niece of Park Chung-hee. So he was very well connected, and he was considered pretty cunning and shrewd. So make of all that what you will. So Kim Jong-pil went on to found the Korean CIA. And when they actually called it the CIA, the American CIA freaked out because they're like, no, like, don't. They're kind of, you know, they didn't really know who these guys were. They were pretty unsure about them. You know, it was said they don't even know if they know how to use chopsticks, you know, sort of saying that they were uneducated hicks, awesome. You know, from the country sort of thing. There's like some really fascinating American intelligence documents when they came to power. And the CIA didn't want a bar of it because they couldn't, you know, they didn't know who these guys were. They didn't know how much, you know, they could control them. They were pretty skeptical about them. And so Moon and Kim were both sort of on the up and up at the same time in the early 60s. So Moon is founding his church and his networks of influence in universities and his business operations. And Kim is obviously trying to reshape the country and obviously do a massive power grab through the KCIA. And I mean, there was all sorts of overlap. This is clearly, they had both risen to the top of this incredibly fractured, impoverished society. And a lot of their early people in their networks, shall we say, had a lot of overlap. Whether it, you know, who was placing who where or whatever, or maybe, you know, just was that there was a small elite rising in the country and it was worthwhile being a member of this church that seemed to have a lot of sway and obviously have your tentacles into this new government and this new intelligence apparatus. But, you know, all explanations, and it's probably some combination, they all make a bit of sense. But they were certainly moving in the same circles. Early US assessments thought that the KCIA was using the Unification Church as a political tool. you know, churches and their nonprofits and governments not looking into them can be very, very handy things.
Yeah. They knew a lot about having churches as front groups, right, already. Mm-hmm. So they're just like, oh, we see. Yeah, we see what you're doing here. No big
deal. Yeah. And basically, the KCIA and the Unification Church were both migrating over to the US by the late 60s, early 70s, and again forming their own networks that were separate but had overlap. And then sort of what came, it's very, very complex, and I'm not going to go into it in great detail, but it sort of became this double-headed hydra that became the Korea Gate scandal in the 1970s. So it was these networks of Korean influence that were bribing, honeypot trapping, you know, various senators, even, you know, the Speaker of the House, Carl Albert, the Democratic Speaker at the time, they'd really, really infiltrated through the KCIA, certainly the American Congress and Senate. And then at the same time, Moon was sort of doing his spiritual uplift. I mean, he was hosting rallies for Nixon when Watergate was really kicking off.
Yeah.
When no one else in the country wanted them. So Nixon's like, oh, okay, well, I've got to have this weirdo into the White House and pray with me. I'm not going to do a Nixon. I don't do a good Nixon, unfortunately. So they both kind of always had overlapping interests and networks and power and centers of influence. I suspect that ultimately, I mean, they were both hardcore Korean nationalists and they were both hardcore anti-communists. So they were happy to work together when it suited them, but they were still also, you know, out for themselves, careerists, corrupt. So both Kim and Moon were doing their own thing, but coming together when it suited them. So basically this all became Korea Gate, which unfolded in the 70s. There's like five different inquiries going on, all sorts of networks of bribery with American rice contracts and all sorts of stuff that's way too long and boring to go into. But I mean, interestingly, I think kind of so many people were implicated in Washington and in the great state of Louisiana and in California as well, and across both parties. So it just became the kind of thing that everyone just kind of wanted to bury. No one really copped it. I think maybe one guy got charged with, it's been a while since I read this chapter.
It got squashed. Yeah. I mean, it's pretty fascinating because like the Moonies as a cultural icon, right? Like as a thing that people know of that name are basically people generally in the background of sometimes like works of fiction of like the late 60s to like the mid 70s, right? Like when the Moonies were coming up kind of as like a pseudo hippie Christian movement, right? Like one of these kind of hippie churches. And then by the 80s, they've like exploded into enormous scandal, right? Like they've grown to the point where they're being investigated as like a cult and like, do they, right? Like are they literally like blackmailing senators and stuff? Like, what the fuck is going on, right?
I mean, most of the investigations into them were more in the 70s. And it led to all sorts of foreign agent lobbying reforms, you know, on Capitol Hill that are still allegedly enforced today. So I guess that's just some of the background of it. But basically, when Nixon was coming in for election, which was the election year where he's like, I've got the secret plan for Vietnam, but I can't tell you. And basically, yeah, so his Nixon doctrine started saying, hey, we're going to pull some troops out of South Korea. We're going to, you know, pull out some military funding. We're going to make this a lot more streamlined. What wound up becoming the Nixon-Kissinger doctrine. That really freaked out Koreans, both in the KCIA and Reverend Moon himself. So that really led to them both sort of really doubling down and their efforts in Washington as just, you know, as patriots, as anti-communists, as hardcore Korean nationalists. Moon called Korea the Adam Nation, and they said that America is the Archangel Nation. So America is meant to look after them. So they felt very, Japan's the Eve Nation because it tempted, it tempted Korea in the occupation. And so this is very deeply felt, I guess, is the important thing from Reverend Moon's point of view, which I guess is what leads you to spaff $40 million on this completely terrible film. Because it really was just a deep matter of ideology. And this is at the time when they really did feel as though they'd been betrayed by America, you know, withdrawing troops and funds. And I think this is really created with a mind to, you know, reminding the American people of the great connection between their two nations. And that's why you see some of the very soppy and kind of weird plot lines and the interracial connections and all those sorts of things.
The romance between the American soldier and the Korean woman with, I believe, a Japanese father.
That's Toshiro Mifune. That is like one of the most famous Japanese in like basically a bit role. And I'm like, that really looks like Toshiro Mifune. And it is. It literally is. And it's like, brother, what are you doing in this piece of shit, man? I mean, Laurence Olivier plays MacArthur, right? Like they paid for a cast here and then pretty much utterly squandered it, I have to say.
I think it was Laurence Olivier. They paid $4 million too for it.
Good for him. God, good for him.
Awesome.
And he is phoning it in some of the scenes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's not his best performance. I would love to know more and more about the actual production and the behind the scenes. Like, when did the Moonies get involved? Because on this show, we've reviewed a Christian film called Homestead. That's just about like a Christian post-apocalyptic film that is based on a very not Christian post-apocalyptic fantasy, basically, of weekend warriors. And they do imprint their evangelical prophecy beliefs onto the script, and fish and loaves become a big part of it, which was never in the source material. And I was wondering if there were any specific examples where, oh yeah, a Mooney clearly had a pass over this section of the script or like that.
Okay, well, I guess if you notice that all the Koreans are exceptionally South, you know, non-communist Koreans are really pure and virtuous.
Yes.
Like the young girl, you know, the young woman and the father, you know, gives the blessing, and again for the interracial marriage, because that was really, you know, what the Moonies were best known for in the US was those mass Madison Square Garden or whatever. And look, a lot of it, I think, was just flat out immigration fraud. It was almost the wives were almost always Japanese or Korean. The husbands were almost always American nationals, and you know they managed to get a lot of free labor and church numbers over to the United States.
If you read about the Moonies, there was a scheme that they had to like do basically a phishing scam where they thought they could get away with phishing in both Japanese, I think, and American international waters if they married Japanese women and American women to like across the ocean, right? They're like, oh, now we have these basically dual national boats. And I think both the governments were like, that's not how any of that works. No, that does not work, ma'am.
You can't arrest a husband and wife for the same crime.
You can't arrest them in both jurisdictions, Connor. Yeah. That is true. So, Elle, it's funny that you mentioned, right, like Inchon being maybe a product of the falling out or the perceived kind of falling out of Korean national interest with American. Because one of the questions I had was, who is this for? Right. Because you watch a movie called Inchon, I knew it wasn't going to be in Korean, but I expected it to have, let's say, more of a Korean perspective, given that it is made by the Moonies. And it is not. Right. I mean, this is I would argue it's like less even than the French parts of like the Battle of Algiers, right? Where like half of the Battle of Algiers is basically seen through the French officers and like military structures point of view. And this is basically all through American eyes, right? All the people that we follow are what's the general's name?
Frank Holdsworth.
Okay. Him and his wife, and then MacArthur, right? And the scenes with MacArthur, you never see a South Korean military officer or general in any of those meetings, right? It is like, it's almost purely just like a colonial conflict. Mm-hmm. They're just the backdrop. They are the helpers and they're not in the room, right? And yeah. I didn't expect that.
No, it's very much made for an American audience. And like I said, because it's, you know, yeah, really highlighting the purity and virtue of Koreans. It's reminding, you know, meant to remind Americans of the special relationship. I mean, I think you used the word falling out of relations between Korea and America before. Moon would straight up say betrayal.
Wow.
Yeah. They would say, yeah, an absolute betrayal. So it is, on the one hand, kind of trying to project a strength that Americans, they think that they would be into, I guess, is the thing. It's like,
yeah.
I mean, we're recording this on the day of Trump losing his mind over Israel and
they don't know what the fuck they're doing.
yeah, Israel and Iran, and you saw that Mark Rutte, the Secretary General of NATO, issued a statement in exactly like Trump cadence with some words capitalized, saying, you know, this is going to be great, it's going to be strong, just to appeal to his vanities, and I suspect to also have a good laugh, you know, that he'll be flattered by that. And I think that this is a bit of the same thing. It's this Moon was very much in his America phase by then. I think he was pretty rumbled by Koreagate. He'd just kind of survived by the skin of his teeth. He'd started getting into bed with the moral majority and people like this in the early 80s. And he was also, very, very shortly about to be on the hook for tax fraud in the United States and go to prison in Connecticut. And so I think it was a bit of a probably feeling more Americanized and connected to the culture, kind of saying, you know, I know what these piggies want. I'm going to, you know, throw some more slop in the bucket. But also very much appealing to them and trying to... He always saw himself as a pioneer and the guy who was going to get things done. Like, he wasn't being ironic when he always thought that he was going to be the guy to achieve world peace, you know, sort of talking about it like a beauty pageant contestant. And so I really thought that I really think he might have been trying to forge, you know, post-Koreagate, post the Nixon doctrine, really trying to forge a new connection between the American and the Korean people.
Well, the piggies did not want it, I'll tell you that much. This thing flopped and it fucking stinks.
Can I tell you another, my other favorite trope that was in it?
Please.
Bitch first wives. You're never gonna guess why.
the romance plot is one of the more misogynist things I've seen in a film. And by the way, like, it's one of the things that it feels like it really dates it. Like, I don't know if you've like watched a lot of old James Bond, right? The like classic Sean Connery kind of like Roger Moore era, like the kind of casual misogyny, I'd say, of the 1970s. And this was produced much later and feels a lot like that, right? Yeah. To where it's like, oh, these women, all you got to do is bet them and then they're back on your side. And then you can leave your Korean girlfriend or maybe she'll die. Right? Like, it does not give you.
There is a scene where Frank Callsworth, who is cheating on his wife and trying to get a divorce, his wife and him reunite and they do sleep together, which was very strange because he just gives this monologue about being like, yeah, of course you would be miserable. I was an army man always being sent around the world and you're a woman. Like, what the hell?
It's what is crazy. This?
And of course, Frank Tallsworth's new beau dies during the invasion of Incheon, and I believe dies off screen. They just like find her on the beach and she's got bullet holes in her. I didn't even see her during the invasion. Why was she there?
She stowed away on the boat or something. We don't know. She sacrificed her life for the liberation of South Korea. Okay.
Frank and Lim's father, the Japanese man, lift her up, put her on a boat. They shake hands, and then the Japanese father just walks into the ocean. He just walks away. Like, wow. All right.
Man reborn or something.
Men will literally conduct a frogman operation into Incheon instead of go to therapy.
Instead of going to couples therapy.
Yeah.
I got it. So audience, by the way, we haven't mentioned it yet, but you can watch this marvelous film on YouTube.
We'll post
the
link.
In all of its 4x3 glory. I'm just going to say the quality's not great, but that
does feel like a recording of the recording.
Yes. I didn't mention earlier that you can sleep easy, right? Because all of those YouTube ads that it plays, and I promise you it does, they thankfully do not go to the Unification Church, as the Unification Church does not allow this movie to be screened, seemingly, and has not issued it on, I think, any reproduction, right? Like VHS or like otherwise. So this is possibly one of the only copies that is licensed. Somehow it's on Tubi also, dubbed into Spanish. And maybe for another episode, Connor, maybe you can look into whether it got licensed somehow to like Univision or something.
I'll try to do a deep dive and find out who's got the licensing rights. Because it's interesting. It sounds like the Moonies are trying to distance themselves from this Razzie Award winning movie.
Because Young it comes
got
up.
The Razzie.
It comes up on lists of like I said, right, like worst movies of all time. It's worth it to put on in the background because we're not going to talk about the film that much more. But like the action sequences are worth at least some of the money they paid to put them on film, right? They are like impressive. Yeah. There's a tremendous amount of extras. They have actual military hardware. At one point, they must have gotten hold of some kind of military, like coastal, like landing ship, because they're doing PT boat shit onto a beach, and it's not just archival footage, right? They're they have shots from like the inside of basically boats launching landing craft, and that's really impressive. They have real tanks, and they blow up like real barrels full of gasoline or whatever. It looks great, right? Lots of squibs, lots of blanks. So that's impressive. The problem is you basically have to fast forward through anything that is not MacArthur talking. And even those scenes, a lot of them are fucking intractable.
Yeah.
Right. And I will say it does a decent job at like portraying the kind of drama of the Incheon landing, which was, by the way, like a military feat, without which it's possible the Americans would not have, defeated the North Korean forces in such like a timely manner, right? And like driven them back. It could have literally changed, had it not worked, it could have literally changed the course of the Korean War and perhaps the Cold War, right?
I do want to ask, and El, if you can speak on this as well, please. I'm not a history buff. I'm not a war history buff. Is this movie historically accurate? All right.
I'm Korean. Well, I'm not a real war history person either. Most of the stuff I have to know about Korea is kind of the post-war. And look, I do have to confess at this point, I knew it was going to be interminable, so I did invite some friends around to watch it with me, and substances were consumed in the watching of the film.
Same.
As I said, the quality isn't great. So towards the end, things are a little bit patchy, and there was just lots of laughter and sort of talking over the top. But I think we did have the interminable battle scene at the end. We did have to fast forward.
I should have done that too. The problem is Alec is the only friend I have who's down to watch this stuff with me, and he's 3 hours away.
It's garbage.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's Our watch parties are basically over since I had a kid, also.
We're stuck. One thing that really stood out to me about this movie is MacArthur. So with the exception of maybe like Colin Powell and Mad Dog Mattis or John McCain, like the most relevant war heroes in American history are like Patton and MacArthur. And this movie does not make MacArthur look like a lion of the military. It makes him look kind of like a Boy Scout.
He looks like a fruitcake. He's a fruitcake.
He was very, he was very kind of effete, wasn't he? Yeah. I mean, did you guys notice as well the endless Caesar references?
Yes, he's comparing himself to Caesar.
Yeah,
straight up just zooming in on the nameplate.
Yeah. Zooming in on a bust
of Caesar.
He's
got a bust in his house. So good.
Silly.
And so I kind of gather that was doing a lot of the heavy lifting, in case he didn't work it out.
Yeah.
He does a lot of praying too, which like, I don't know. I'm not familiar with like MacArthur's religiosity. That could be kind of a nod in the Mooney direction. There's a lot of praying. There's a lot of references. MacArthur directly references God a lot.
Yeah.
Right. And there's a lot of peripheral
praying under a portrait of Jesus as well.
So I don't know her name, the wife subplot in which
Jacqueline Bisset.
Okay.
That's the
in which she acquires some Korean children that are basically fleeing the North Korean army and drops them off at like an orphanage, right? They make special note to kind of talk about God and do some prayers and right, like it's just a lot of Christian themes, right? God's always in the background. God's a motivator for these characters. Yeah.
The movie even ends with MacArthur reciting the Lord's Prayer at the European Union or at the UN. Like, this is cringe, my man. This is so silly.
I think it's just straight up saying shared heritage. And I mean, Moon, genuinely did, was subject to a lot of racism in the United States and, was very much a folk devil at this time in the US. And there was, all sorts of stuff, particularly in liberal press, saying all sorts of nasty things about him. So I think it was a bit of a, we might look different, but we pray to the same God. And really just trying to.
And we're on your side against.
Yeah.
We're on your side against these commie bastards, right? Like if there's one thing I think that that like makes this good propaganda, right? Or like a good attempt at propaganda is it frames the conflict, importantly, very well. it starts when the North Koreans invade, and it has none of the background of the Korean War. It has none of the drama of the dual elections, right? Of the election of Syngman Rhee, boycotted by the communists, right? Of the parliamentary election of the Koreans. It's got none of the background of like the North Koreans fighting in China, of the actual occupation itself, right? So Korea is an occupied territory of Imperial Japan during the Second World War, and it's basically divvied up, right, between let's just say broadly controlled communist control, Chinese and North Korean, right, and American control. And you would think that it's not, right, it's not an embattled state. It's not like we have to occupy the Koreans. You could give them their own government, but it's exceedingly clear to the Americans that if they do so, it will just fall to the communists, right, to Korean communists. Not just to like foreign invasion or like Soviet control, right, or something like this. It will just become another communist state because of the relationship that North Korea has with China. It skips over like the like slaughter of Jeju and like the
don't they just mention Jeju in passing?
Do they? I must have missed it.
I thought you and I talked about that because they do show lots of scenes. Well, two or three scenes of North Koreans just coming in and massacring South Koreans left and right,
forcing
South Koreans to massacre themselves or massacre each other.
But Jeju critically happens before the invasion, right? Okay. So like there's a series of sympathetic communist uprisings in South Korea, all of which basically put down by the ROK / the Americans, right? It is an occupied country. And critically, the film is not really interested in that part of the Korean War. And, you know, aptly, right, for their purpose.
Yeah, I think they're probably, and this is just a bit of a guess, but probably thinking that it's assumed knowledge in the US. You know, that's, you know, everyone in Korea would know about this, but, you know, obviously, because the US was around as well, they would too, you know, not really realizing that, you know, it's a footnote in history, I suppose, for most Americans.
All of Korean War is the footnote for most Americans. Like, yeah. Korean War and the War of 1812 are two wars that just kind of get glazed over.
Don't care.
Yeah.
Even though I think, isn't it more ordnance was proportionally dropped in the Korean War than the Vietnam War?
Astounding. Yes. Yeah. It's, and by the way, right, like the other thing is like the utter bloodthirstiness of the North Koreans in this film is, would you believe it, not very historically accurate, right? As is evidenced by the fact that they treated their POWs a lot better than we treated the POWs that we captured of North Koreans, famously. But anyway, right, like it's a propaganda flick. It is what it is. And you just kind of have to roll with that.
So you said the P word, so why don't we go ahead and touch on this? Is this movie propaganda? Why or why not? In what ways? I mean, it's pretty simplistic. It seems for me, as someone who's not a Korean War buff, it's like, okay, cool. It took one great man of history in order to like get the ball rolling on this war that I assume we won. It doesn't say anything else.
Didn't we know?
I think that as a work of propaganda, it is quite multifaceted, and we've sort of touched a lot on this stuff. So as I said, you know, yeah, the non-communist Koreans are all pure and virtuous. There's, you know, just lots of things it touches on that are obviously, you know, beliefs. Like, because it kind of had that thing, you know, when you see a film from the 70s or 80s like that, and you're like, oh, suddenly, like, the black sidekicks appeared, like, oh, how's he going to die? You know, and there's all sorts of, like, interracial, you know, and it's like, it's all meant to be, yeah, because he was the interracial marriage guy. So it's just like, yeah, you know, we can all just hop in the back of the car and drive off and shoot some commies and we can all get along. so there's a lot of that. I think certainly I watched, you know, with friends who obviously aren't steeped in Mooney's lore as I am. And we sort of had to stop, and I had to explain to them about Tongil armaments and how much of a, just straight away that stood out to me. It hadn't even occurred to me before I watched the film of like what a showcase it was for a lot of their weaponry. And so I think in some ways it's a bit of a, you know, it's a bit of a dick on the table kind of thing from Moon. He's saying, you know, I've made it. Look at all the cool stuff that I have. I can finance a movie about it.
It rules whenever you see real tanks in a movie like this, right? Whenever you're like, ooh, this stinks. And then a bunch of tanks roll through a scene, you're like, oh, damn, okay. wait, I'm going to give this a second chance.
Yeah, and someone died in the filming of it. Like, yeah. Yeah, it was like, it is pretty intense. That was the thing that was remarkable. I mean, if you were a real like military or battle nerd, which I'm not, you'd probably get something out of just watching some of the battle scenes, because they are kind of, they're pretty wild, right?
Oh yeah. Man, Al, you clearly shown that you don't listen to this podcast, because Alec will talk about counting the bullets that go off in each scene of a movie. Be like, oh, he ran out of bullets right here. How come he's still firing?
By the way, Elle co-hosts her wonderful podcast, Hell to Pay, with friend of the show, Amr, right, who has brought us wonderful features such as
Lion of the Desert,
right, which is like the good version of this, right, which is like a war epic that really, really delivers. And like the side plots are like very sympathetic, yes. Right? But
on the side plot thing, like Lion of the Desert is nearly 3 hours long. It's longer than this one. And it really succeeds where this one fails, in that the subplots that are focused on aren't about various people on your side. It's about the opposing side. What's so interesting is that the Italians, there are sympathetic Italians on this movie about Libyan liberation and Libyan oppression by the Italians. We don't get that in this movie. Instead, we get like Frank Holsworth and his wife Barbara, who, Alec, I can't believe you didn't know their names. They say them once.
Sorry.
Or how about Army Sergeant August Henderson, who repairs Barbara's car? Like, what about all this?
American ingenuity, American know-how. What's his like line? He tries to do like a line.
There is a great Chekhov's gun moment around there. Did you guys see like when the car stalls, when she's taking the kids and there's like, you know, pulls open the glove box or whatever, mm-hmm. and pulls out a gun sort of thing. And you just, my friends and I were just all screaming, Chekhov's gun. Like you're just waiting for it to be seen later on.
Sure enough, just pew, shoots.
She murders a guy that that the children say is a North Korean agent, and she just blows this Korean away. It's crazy. He's like, stop the car, ma'am, and she's like, boom, fucking like drive-bys his ass.
And again, right, that's pure and virtuous Korean children, and look what we can get the Archangel people to do for us. Like, we can get them to do our dirty work. That's genuinely a trope that I don't think is undeliberate.
So in the interest of time, because Elle, I know you we don't have you for too much longer, Alec, you've also been talking about Syngman Rhee and how you've noticed there's a lot of similarities between him and Sun Myung Moon, the founder of the Moonies. Do you want to go off on that?
It's just, there are like parallels between, by the way, him personally and Sun Myung Moon, and then like kind of the film itself, right? As these kind of products of America, right? So Syngman Rhee is basically one of these government in exile kind of guys. So by the time he returns and kind of becomes the figurehead of the American occupation in South Korea, he's basically thoroughly Americanized. And in a different way, Sun Myung Moon's move to the United States basically Americanizes him, right? Because I think he spends basically most of the rest of his life in the United States. Or is that more complicated?
Yeah, he is. I mean, he was always traveling around. I was going to say, in truth, he was in private jets and casinos. he did spend a lot more of time in the 90s in Brazil and places like that. But I actually think I can really see a real mirror with him and Kim Il-sung, leader and founder of North Korea. Kim Il-sung was Pentecostal, had a similar, you know, visited by God when he was a teenage boy and had all of these visions. And sort of brought together kind of this, you know, sort of bastardized theology, you know, that is very heavily, you know, uses a lot of Pentecostal thought and influence.
Juche is famously theist, right? Which is unique among, you know, communist movements, basically.
Yeah. And I believe any mention of Marx and communism, things like that, I think are banned in North Korea now. There's actually a fantastic book B.R. Myers wrote about Juche thought. I think it might've been like 10, 20 years ago. And just explains how it's like, this like race purity theory and a lot of the stuff I've sort of been talking about, you know, virtuous Koreans and things like that, and just how like not communist it is, basically, and how much of it is just so steeped in illusions about mountains and, you know, when the Kim's son met Bill Clinton, that it was in front of a picture of crashing waves and, you know, all this stuff that it's meant to represent. And I can see a lot of kind of funhouse mirror stuff going on between Sung Young Moon and Kim Il-sung. And, you know, they were kind of both obsessed with it. Well, Moon was certainly very obsessed with Kim, and eventually wound up meeting his son and doing some stuff to try and unify the two countries in the 1990s.
Okay, well,
way better answer than what I was going for.
are there any final thoughts before we wrap up?
Like one last thing is like, I'm sure Elle, like you noticed that the film has MacArthur basically describe containment as well, right? Like it's very, very clear, like how it wants to frame Korea in the broader narrative about like American anti-communism and foreign policy and like who America is in the world. And it does throw like through MacArthur, right? Who's just like, it, like in a way that's almost like derisive to American support for Korea. He's just like, the landing at Incheon will mean this for the Korean War, and that will mean this for American support in South Asia, and it will mean this for you know, fighting the Kremlin, right? It's like very nakedly just not entirely about Korea.
Yeah, it's interesting you pick that up. Moon was just a very instrumental person in everything he did. You know, that's really how he saw a lot of relations, and everything was always a means to get to something else. And every relationship was something that could be juiced later on or whatever. So yeah, he was definitely he was a big picture guy, not so much a details guy, I guess you'd say.
It also sounds like that scene was written specifically to highlight the actual successes post-Korean War instead of like what their failed goals were. Okay.
Successes like Vietnam.
Yeah. Yeah. You may remember me from such successes as the Vietnam War, yeah.
So, Elle, I want to give you an opportunity to talk about Hell to Pay a bit. Could you share for our listeners what this podcast is? I mean, I know I'm it really is one of my favorite podcasts. I've gotten some really cool information out of it. I just picked up Gareth Gore's book Opus, that, you know, he did an Opus Day. Anyway, I'm talking too much. You tell us about the podcast.
No, it's cool. So myself and Arma, who's obviously been on the podcast, and you guys know he's just such a brilliant and cool guy, and very funny, and another friend of ours, Sipo, who lives in South Africa, we just got together and doing a podcast that's focused on spiritually motivated crime and conflict around the world. So we're all kind of, you know, I think we all know each other from maybe like, you know, we're all Radio War Nerd fans and, you know, just from back in the Twitter days and things like that. And yeah, so we just thought we'd just have a bit of fun telling some stories, doing a bit of banter. Just talking about, you know, something I write about a lot, that Arma's, you know, done a lot of episodes on Radio War Nerd, and Sipo knows a lot about as well, which I think is just kind of tends to be missed a lot in sort of modern, generally secular media discourse, which is like the spiritual element to so many things that go on in the world. And that's obviously why I'm interested in the Moonies. And I also wrote a book called Beyond Belief, How Pentecostal Christianity is Taking Over the World, and sort of traveled around the world seeing the fastest growing religion and in all sorts of contexts. We're just a bit of a different take on world events and historical stuff. And just three people with, you know, that come from very different cultures, just trying to look at stories, you know, particularly Arma's originally from the Middle East, Sipo's African, and just trying to look at some interesting aspects of history and culture and global politics that mightn't get so much coverage around the rest of the world.
Yeah, I
banger podcast.
Great, yeah,
thank you.
I personally recommend episode 13, which is about Apollo Quiboloy. I believe I'm pronouncing that right.
Quiboloy.
Absolutely insane, gripping tale of like this wild guy in the Philippines. And on your book, Beyond Belief, I work in radio. I've been working in radio for so long. And thank you for highlighting Amy Simple McPherson, one of radio's first women warriors.
Might have been the first mass media woman in the world, some people say. So yeah, we're actually, I need to do an episode about her soon because she had a very, very strange disappearance for a while, but yeah, she's a fascinating figure for sure.
Did you happen to watch the Perry Mason reboot on HBO?
I did not know.
Season one is a, you know, it's all set in L.A. and it's the classic 1930s L.A. crime kind of story. But there is a character that is so clearly based on her up to like her mysteriously disappearing. It's a pretty interesting take. So I can't recommend a show really, but maybe a montage of clips with her character in it. I think cool, Tatiana Maslany plays her. Okay, Elle, where can we find your information? Where can you find your work online?
Sure. So ellehardy.com is just where I kind of keep my work and whatnot. My name's unique, I think. So you can find me on like Twitter, Blue Sky, Instagram. I'm trying not to be on social media as much at the moment because I'm supposed to be writing a book, but I still spend much of time on it. Yeah. And obviously on Hell to Pay.
All right. Well, on that, Elle, thank you so, so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. Whenever you wrap up your book on the Moonies, please come back. We'd love to talk more. I want to know more about the moon's son with the crown made of gold bullets.
Oh, yeah. King Bullethead. I've met him. I've been out to his festival and interviewed him. He has a fantastic YouTube channel and Instagram where he does a lot of rap videos and things like that. So it seems like something you guys would probably be into.
Oh yeah. Time to do a deep dive, Alec.
Cool. Well, great. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course.
Thanks for watching the bloody movie with me.
It was a pleasure, Alec. It was a
pleasure. Go through our archives and you'll see that this is not the worst thing we've watched. We also watched, I think the worst thing I didn't watch it for the podcast, but King of Kings, the South Korean animated Christian movie. I don't know if you know about Angel Studios, Elle, but I religiously watch nearly everything on Angel Studios.
Well, not religiously, literally.
not literally religiously, yeah. I'm in some weird cosmic battle with them, and I watch so much of their stupid crap. Anyway. All right, well, let me do the tagline. Excelsior, Propagandos, and as always, keep your eyes on the skies. Did you finish it?
No.
We have two podcast hosts that have no idea what the fuck they're doing.
They've been fighting for a long time on the podcast.
They started talking about current events, and then it was focused on Louisiana and Texas, and now they are going all over the place. It's off the fucking rails.
It's shitty movies. At first, it was kind of good, and now they only talk about shitty movies, and they're getting worse and worse, folks.
They wanted to talk about propaganda. They are only... Oh, God damn it.